Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day. All right, everybody. Well, welcome back to another episode of Behind the Knife. This is a very, very special episode. We are live covering the Academic Surgical Congress annual meeting. We're very thankful. They kindly asked us to come and cover the meeting and interview some of the participants, and we're very excited about it. Kevin, what meeting are we at? What is this all about?
Yeah, so the Academic Surgical Congress is really the premier meeting for surgeons around the country that are involved in academics, in both in education and in research. And it's actually a combination of the AAS, the Association of Academic Surgeons, in the SUS, the Society of University Surgeons. And so it's a great meeting with lots of big names, and they really focus on getting residents involved and junior faculty even the med students. But John, with no further ado, who do we got on the podcast today?
Yeah, Kevin, we interviewed a lot of people today, but to bring you for our day one ASC meeting, we have Taylor Riehl, Dr. Brian Zuckerbron. We have a rundown of the first trial with Dr. Carl Billamoya. We have we interviewed some junior staff that are here, seeing some of the conference, and we had their take on the ASC. And then we also have Dr. Lillian Cowell.
Yeah, so we talked to a lot of people today. You know, basically we're running around like crazy talking to people at this meeting. There's a lot of big names, a lot of heavy hitters. You know, the first trial, New England Journal of Medicine, just came out today. We're going to be releasing a daily podcast throughout this meeting. It's good both for people at the meeting who can't make it. There's no way you could possibly make it to all the things at the meeting today. It's also good for people who aren't able to maybe make it down to the meeting. We're covering some of the topics covered and talking to some of the authors. So if you can't be here in person, this is, you know, the next best thing. So.
And here is Dr. Taylor Riehl.
So we're excited to have Taylor Riehl here. So she is the brand new chief of the Division of General Surgery and Surgical Oncology at University of Arizona in Tucson. Taylor, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thank you.
So for those who aren't as familiar, tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, how it came to the point where at the University of Arizona.
So I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey. I went to medical school in Baltimore. I trained at Johns Hopkins. So I spent 13 years in Baltimore between my surgical training and my research fellowship. And my last year as a pancreatic biliary fellow, or what they called at the time, assistant chief of service. I finished training in 2005, and I took my first job in Galveston at University of Texas Medical Branch, where Dr. Townsend was the chair. He's been an amazing mentor and friend, and I had an incredible 10 years in Galveston. My research focus was primarily health services and outcomes research, and I started an outcomes research group there, basically from the start, because nobody was doing that there when I went. That was a great experience. I built a great team. I had a great clinical practice there. And I just had a new opportunity in Arizona. Over the last 2 years, I've taken a shift in career direction a little bit. And the opportunity at Arizona really offered me a chance to take my career in this new direction. So Dr. Neumeier's the chair, and she's open to some of the new ideas I hope to bring to Arizona.
So what brings you to this meeting? Why come to the ASC, and what does the ASC mean to you as far as your career and professional development?
And so they started the ASC almost exactly when I finished training. So the first annual ASC, which was the combined AAS and SUS meeting. I was an AAS member initially and then an SUS member several years after that. And it's just been one of the surgical organizations that's been the foundation for my career. I've come to this meeting every year since its inception, and even before that when they were separate meetings. I love this meeting because I get to interact with all my academic colleagues. I get to see some of the best science around, and it's just been a real opportunity for me to grow in my leadership from the AAS side and then to the SUS side. So just tremendous opportunities with this organization.
So you're the chair of the membership committee for the SUS. And so for people out there who are looking to get involved, or maybe they're the AAS members and they want to kind of cross over, can you talk a little bit about that process and maybe some of the things that the SUS looks for? I know that in recent years they've expanded a little bit to be maybe a little bit more inclusive. Can you touch on that?
So I think, you know, very historically, the SUS was a very much a basic science organization, and the SUS has really changed with the changing face of surgical research and surgical culture. The SUS has defined criteria for their membership that are on the website. They include publications and grant funding, participation in this meeting, actually, and then leadership positions. And it's a combination of those things. We really require three of the four of those things. And as membership committee chair, I'll be rotating off the membership committee, but basically anybody who ever has any question about whether they think they qualify for SUS membership, if they think it's too early, too late, I'm happy to look over their CV. I'm happy to give them advice, how I think it would, what would improve their chances, if they should wait a year, all of those things.
Now, we have a lot of residents that listen to this podcast. Can you speak a little bit about why it's important for residents to be involved and how they get involved?
So this is a great meeting for residents to be involved. It's I would bring all of my residents here. So all my research fellows, they come every year. They get opportunities to learn how to do oral presentations. They can join the AAS as resident members. And not only can they join the AAS as resident members, but they can be on committees. They actually have residents on committees in the AAS. So it's a really great way to understand how the organizations work, to transition into leadership positions very early, and to be involved in the society. And then as you start to come to the meeting, you naturally get involved with the SUS because the two are so closely integrated. So it's a really nice relationship and a really great place for residents to get started.
So you talked very briefly and touched on how your life has taken you maybe in a little bit of a different direction. And one of the interesting things that you and I have talked about in the past is this idea of executive coaching and kind of what you're going through right now, kind of bringing mindfulness and engagement and emotional intelligence and things like that. As a new leader in a division, tell us a little bit about this. How did this get started? And how do you go about implementing that in terms of this new leadership position?
So that's something I'm learning right now. So I was recently certified as a professional life and leadership coach in October of 2014. And I did my coach training at the Institute for Professional Excellence in Coaching. But there's lots of different coaching programs out there. I chose it for personal reasons. But I actually came to coaching through my own personal experience with burnout. So I had a very successful career. I looked great on paper, and anybody looking in from the outside would think I had it all, but I was unhappy. You know, I just worked all the time. I was exhausted. I had no balance in my life, and I felt like I was bad at everything I did. I thought, you know, I'm a bad surgeon, I'm a bad teacher, I'm a bad investigator, a bad wife, a bad triathlete.
Yeah, I was going to say, and we're talking about somebody who's published over several hundred manuscripts, has risen to the statures in a very short time period, and is a triathlete. You beat me at the punch. So,
but because I didn't have time to do any of those things right. Well. And, you know, I mean, it's just sort of ironic because you work hard to get to this point, and then all of a sudden you're there and you're not happy. So with that, I needed emergent back surgery about 2 years ago, and that was sort of, and I just got to this point where I'm like, I can't do this anymore, and something had to change. And, you know, you think, well, how can you change it? Because you're a little bit a slave to the lifestyle that medicine provides. And I thought, I have no other marketable skills, which isn't true, but that's what I thought. And I sort of met my first coach. So I didn't know anything about coaching or how that worked, and it was an amazing process. So I think the key idea is that, you know, I was the only one who could change that situation. And it allowed me to sort of shift to take responsibility for my own action and my own behavior and my own results. And once I could do that, you could sort of shift your perspective. So I went for the professional coaching course, and my initial idea was to leave medicine, actually, and to take care of doctors and to help doctors who are experiencing the same kind of burnout that I experienced. And as my perspective shifted, I wanted to be back in medicine. I wanted to take care of patients again. And I thought, I have a real opportunity because I have leadership positions in surgery nationally, institutionally, and I have a chance to change the way that we train surgeons and the way that we develop faculty. And what if I could teach these things to surgeons before they got to the point that I did? And maybe I can or maybe I can't, but I believe that I can. And so Dr. Neumeier has a very similar philosophy, and you know, she's been in Arizona a little more than, I guess, almost a year and a half now, and she's really trying to create an intentional culture in Arizona, and she believes in these ideas. So I think, how do you change the culture and the environment? I think it's slow, you know, but you go in and you're consistent about your message and consistent about the way that we interact. We have a lot of tools that we use in coaching that I introduce into the way that I develop my faculty, the way that we're developing the residents, and we're actually hoping to create a formal resiliency well-being mm-hmm. program, you know, for our residents that incorporates a lot of the coaching concepts and really maybe have a solution to the problem instead of increasing awareness, which is important. So that's what we're trying to do.
That's awesome.
So I'm very interested in your physician wellness training and mentorship. I was wondering, as residents, how can we get plugged in to learn how, is there a book out there? Is there...
So there's lots of books out there, you know, so for me, a lot of these concepts were really abstract. So I was like, yeah, mindfulness, you know, but how do I do that? And so a model I use is called Energy Leadership, and there I can send you the link to the book, but it's Energy Leadership by Bruce Schneider, and it actually gave me the how. So it gave me I'm a surgeon, so, you know, I don't deal with abstract concepts, so I needed a set of rules and a process for how to do it. And so it sort of allows me to do that, and I teach that to my residents. You know, I actually coach individual physicians sort of outside my role in the University of Arizona. So working through that process, but I'd be happy to make any of those.
So thank you. That's wonderful. So just to wrap things up, it kind of goes along those lines. If you could go way back in time to your first day of internship, you know, what's a piece of advice that you would give yourself?
So, you know, to not be a victim to my environment, you know, to take responsibility for my own thoughts and actions and understand that if I don't like the way something went, I have the ability to respond to that in a different way. And I think for me, that's been the key, because nothing in my environment's changed, only my ability to respond to it. And so I think if you can teach people to sort of recognize how they're responding in different situations and create awareness around that, you can change it. And to really define your own success. So don't let the traditional model define success for you.
Well, Taylor, we can't thank you enough for joining us, taking time. I know you're busy, and have a wonderful meeting here in Jacksonville.
Thank you.
All right, so we found in the hall Dr. Brian Zuckerbrown, who is the Chief of Trauma Professor of Surgery at the University of Pittsburgh. And thanks for allowing us to kind of accost you and drag you in here to kind of go over some things. So welcome to Behind the Knife.
Yeah, thank you.
So one of the things that, can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, and how it came to the point that you're at University of Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I was born and raised in a suburb of New York City. I ended up going to my undergraduate med school in Chicago and Northwestern, and went to Pittsburgh as a resident in 1997, did a research fellowship as part of that residency, and then stayed on for faculty.
So one of the questions we've been asking a lot of people is what the ASC means to them. What kind of good memories have you had from the conference over the years, or anything that kind of stands out to you?
Yeah, both. It's been a wonderful evolution to see the ASC grow out of the joint efforts of the AAS and SUS, both societies, which have meant a great deal to me, and I think really fondly about, both from the standpoint of fostering opportunities as a resident, people who really had no reason to be supportive of me, helped promote my career, got me involved. And I think the joint efforts of the two, of the ASC, have really, you know, paid off in dividends. Just look at the attendance of the meeting and the interest, so it's fantastic.
Brian, you've done a lot of research, but one of the things I would be amiss not to ask you about is the loop ileostomy trial with C. diff. Mm-hmm. That gets a lot of pub out there. It gets a lot of talk, a lot of controversy. Give us a little bit of background about how you kind of came up with this idea, and then kind of, what's it like when, you know, like, it stirs like a national type thing where people are like talking about your trial and right. Like debating it on a national scene and everything like that. Can you give us a little insight into that?
Yeah, C. diff is obviously, you know, present everywhere, but there happen to be some locations that seem to be hotspots, of which Western Pennsylvania is one of them, where we just have a higher rate. Fortunately, not necessarily just our hospital, but regionally. And so it's something I've always been interested in, because it's so hard to predict who's going to get better, who's not going to get better, who's going to respond to standard therapies, who is not. And then when you do go to the operating room, it's so, the colon can look so unimpressive and not really correlate with disease. And it's not necrotic and dead and unhealthy. And it always struck me that we're doing a resection-based procedure for something that has the potential to recover. And so you know, akin to someone having an abscess that was making them septic. You surely wouldn't cut off their leg if you could drain the abscess. And so initially my interest in C. diff as a clinical disease came from the idea of maybe we would be able to see patterns to recognize who was going to respond to therapy, who wasn't, early recognition factors that would suggest failure in patients that might need an operation, and to intervene earlier surgically. But then it just kind of struck me that if there was a way to get source control by removing the pathogens and the toxins in the setting of a viable colon that could recover, why not leave it? And if you look through the literature, there's a smattering of stuff out there that would suggest that could be adequate. So building on that, talking with other members of the AAS, SUS, people that I know through these societies and other societies, mm-hmm. like the SIS, have an interest in this disease, and bounce it off them. One of my great mentors at Pitt, Dr. Richard Simmons, really was someone who's got a great career in surgical infectious disease, really helped support me in doing so. So just like anything, having the support of a great mentor is helps to push things forward. And it was great when, fortunately, we had good experience early on and it enabled us to push forward. And it's been really great mm-hmm. talking to other people, seeing that they've adopted the therapy, and continues to be a point where people are going to find out more information and contribute to our understanding of, is there a population that this is better for? Is this a population that colectomy might be a better initial choice? So,
I think it's interesting, out of all the things, is that you may have changed the way that we treat a disease. If you really think about it, I mean, I know you probably don't think about it that, but it's a paradigm shift in terms of the way we go about there. Have you had much flack? People are like, no, that's the wrong. You're committing malpractice here. You shouldn't do that. Have you had any of that stuff?
Not so much. I mean, not at home. And Pittsburgh's been a great environment, like so many centers, where people we were doing so poorly from the way we were standardly treating these patients, using colectomy as really a salvage therapy. So I think the fact that we were doing so poorly made it a little bit easier to try something else that was out there. But there are still people who are doubters and naysayers, or just want more information, or are looking for the right patient to try it on initially. So,
and then, so final words for any residents or medical students or everybody out there specifically that are looking about coming to this meeting or joining these organizations, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would encourage them 100% to get involved. It's really the opportunities at so many different levels, just to meet people, be involved, to network with people you're going to spend the rest of your career with, and it's really fantastic to have these general academic societies that extend beyond the area in which you're practicing or are going to practice, and it's really unique, and so I look forward to it every year.
Okay, well, to round it out, we ask everybody this question. If you go back on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
I don't want to go back to the first day of my internship.
It's the first time we heard that one.
Yeah,
that's good.
But, the whole it's not necessarily the first day, but the whole process, it isn't a means to an end. It's your life. It's an incredibly unique opportunity. Look at it as the first step in your professional career, and it's just a fantastic opportunity to enjoy it.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join us on Behind the Knife, and look forward to future discussions.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we just got finished with Dr. Zuckerbrunn, but we never did close the loop on the loop ileostomy in the treatment of C. diff. Kevin, can you give us a rundown of that?
Yeah, so yeah, we talked about how he came to this study, but we didn't talk about what they actually did. So the surgical approach they took was they created a loop ileostomy, and they did an intraoperative colonic lavage with warm polyethylene glycol electrolyte solution, also with vancomycin flushes. And they compared this against patients that were getting colectomies, and they showed that that loop ileostomy and colonic lavage were an acceptable alternative to colectomy.
Yeah, it's certainly innovative, and we'll see how it changes the practice in the future.
So probably the one of the biggest talks, one of the most popular talks today has been the discussion around the first trial. Everybody has been talking about it at the conference today. Twitter's been blowing up. It's been all over the internet. It's just released in electronic today from the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's the flexibility in duty hour requirements for surgical trainees trial, the first trial. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Carl Abilamora, the first author on this trial, here with us. It's going to discuss it more in detail. But Kevin, why don't you just kind of take us through, you know, the details of the study design and what exactly this looked at?
Right. Yeah. Any surgical study gets published in the New England Journal, we all get pretty excited. So what this did, they had 115 programs, surgical programs, training programs, in 148 hospitals. 58 were using the standard duty hour policies where the interns had to subscribe to the 16 hours and the ones that he'll discuss further. And 57 were under the new flexible policy. And so they did a head-to-head comparison between these two groups. And the primary outcomes in this, as Dr. Abilamora will talk about more, there's no difference in the primary outcome, which was serious death or serious morbidity between the two groups. And then what they also looked at, they looked at a lot of the resident outcomes. They wanted to see what the residents felt of this. And there's no difference in the rates of dissatisfaction with education quality or overall well-being between the two groups. There are some notable differences in the resident secondary outcomes. Residents in the flexible policy group were significantly less likely to be dissatisfied with continuity of care. So they thought in the flexible group, they thought there was more continuity of care, and they thought there was better quality of handoffs and transitions in care because they weren't forced to leave the hospital at these prescribed times. But they were more dissatisfied with their rest. In the flexible policy, residents were also less likely to perceive a negative effect of duty hour policies on patient safety, clinical, and operative outcomes. However, the flexible policy residents did feel more effects of the duty hours on personal time away from the hospital with greater perception of negative effects on several measures. There's no significant difference, though, in perceived effects on duty hours on job satisfaction or morale. So this is a very important paper, and it's one of the first randomized controlled trials looking at duty hours. And that synopsis was done by one of our contributors, Andrea Merrill, a good friend of ours. So thank you, Andrea, for that.
Yeah, that was an issue. Andrea has a very nice, you know, breakdown on her blog, and she's been a longtime friend of the show. So thanks for that.
It's actually the New England Journal's blog.
Written by Andrea Merrill. She's working there now. Is that?
Yep.
Oh, good for her. Good for her. Without any further ado, we're going to get right to Dr. Abilamora. Dr. Abilamora, thank you for being here today. If you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you first became involved in this trial.
So I trained at Northwestern. I did my residency there, and then I went on to do a surgical oncology fellowship at MD Anderson. During my residency, I did a fellowship at the American College of Surgeons. I was the first clinical scholar in residence. And so my connection with the college and its quality program started at this point. And so I think that's really why when the ABS and the ACS were thinking about having someone generate evidence on this topic, they came to me and our team to talk about this and figure out how a trial could be done.
Before we dive in, I'd like to kind of articulate the problem and what kind of led to this. So I know in 2003 was the first time that we had any duty hour restrictions. Is that how it works? And then in 2011, they instituted the more kind of strict for the interns. Can you break that down for us?
Right. So in 2003, we started with the first national surgical duty hour requirements. And that brought in the 80-hour work week. But it also brought with it a lot of other requirements that potentially impacted continuity of care and increased handoffs. And the surgical community has been constantly worried about this. We adapted, but there still have been concerns. And then in 2011, when they cut the intern cap to 16 hours, that really raised people's attention and worries about this even further. And so the entire purpose of the study was to test what happens if we get rid of the requirements, specifically the ones that impact continuity of care. And so we got rid of the 24-hour cap for residents, the 16-hour cap for interns, the 8 to 10 hours off after shifts or between shifts, and the 14 hours off after a 24-hour call. All of those potentially could impact your ability to take good care of your patients and get a good education and training. And so those were the ones we were particularly interested in testing.
Why do you think this is? I mean, I'm a little shocked or surprised about kind of the emotional chord that this topic has struck, both from residents and staff, younger staff, older staff. It seems to be a very hot button issue, and this is certainly exemplified by, you know, the study coming out today, and it's just been on the Twitter and everywhere else, just kind of caught on by wildfire. Why do you think that is?
I think some of it may have to do with the fact that until now we have not had a randomized trial or really high level evidence, and so, you know, people can choose which retrospective study they want to use to support their data and their position. And so that's why I think this trial is particularly getting a lot of attention. It's the first trial and appropriately named because it is the first one at the national level. And I think it really will help to inform future duty hour policies. I think it's a professionalism issue, and people take that very, very personally as well. And I think that's why it draws a lot of attention, and rightfully so.
So if you don't mind, I know you've been talking about it all day, you know, just for our listeners, just give us a brief, you know, rundown of the study design and the findings.
The study is a pragmatic, non-inferiority, cluster randomized control trial. So the study essentially broke the 117 programs into two groups. The standard policy group, which adhered to current ACGME guidelines, and then the flexible policy group, where we waived the four rules that we talked about. And then we sought to examine what happened with patient outcomes, and that was our primary outcome measure, and we used NISQIP as the data platform for that. And our primary outcome measure was death or serious morbidity. That's sort of the bottom line of surgical care. And we also were very interested and knew it was quite important to study the perspective of the residents. And so we defined two domains of primary outcomes for the resident survey results, and that was their overall well-being and their overall quality of education. So overall, we found that there was no difference in patient outcomes for between either of the study arms. And that held up even when we looked at high-risk patients or inpatients or people who were potentially at increased risk of, you know, a duty hour related issue. On the patient, on the resident outcome side, we found that there was no significant difference between the study arms in their overall well-being or in their education quality. And those were good summary measures, but a lot of the more interesting detail came in some of the other answers, where residents in the flexible arm made it fairly clear that they thought they were able to provide better care, had much better continuity of care, and had several aspects of their training that were better under flexible policies. They did note that there were some issues with time for family and friends and for extracurricular activities. They noted that the time allotted for that was an issue, but when you ask them about their satisfaction, again, they noted that there was no difference. And so it shows that they're willing to make this trade-off, right? So we all sort of think about this when we talk to medical students who are interested in surgery. We talk about the fact that you might have to give up some of your hobbies and some of your time outside of work to focus on taking good care of patients and getting a strong training during those 5 years.
Now, I heard you talk about this briefly earlier, sir. How do you think this is going to change policy? Do you think it's going to be initial change? Do you think there's going to be more investigation before we change anything?
The ACGME has convened a duty hours task force to look at the results of this trial, all the previous literature, and to take testimony from all the stakeholders. And so we think that this trial's results suggest that flexibility is reasonable to introduce into the next revision of duty hour policies. And so the ACGME is going to look at that closely. And as we heard from Dr. Potts from the ACGME today, they're actually trying to do this by July 1, 2016. So at least come to a strong decision before then about what they're going to do. So we think that the results of the trial are policy relevant and will impact policy fairly soon.
So I was reading some of the critiques online, and something kind of came up that I had never even considered in this, but it was about the consent of residents and the ethics, the bioethics behind this. Can you just touch a little bit on that, how to be careful in studies like this? How I know you guys did address that.
Sure.
and how you guys went about addressing that?
We spent a lot of time thinking about that particular issue before we even started the trial or put pen to paper about how do we make sure that we are going through the process correctly, and are the study subjects the residents or the patients or the institutions? And the litmus test for this is what happened previously. So the ACGME was able to change policies in 2003 and 2011 without consenting anybody. Mm-hmm. And they were able to do it without a study ongoing. And so after talking with our IRB, the IRBs of other programs in the study, and then bioethicists, we decided that we would pursue the IRB approval at Northwestern, but it turned out that they deemed it to be non-human subjects research because they saw it as the institution was the study subject. It's the one that would opt in or out of the trial. And to further support that notion, at each institution, the chair of surgery, the program director, the DIO, the designated institutional official in charge of GME, all of them had to sign off. In addition, the GME committee at each institution had to sign off. So we had no fewer than 700 people who literally signed off on the trial. So we had a lot of things in place to protect all of the people involved, particularly the residents.
I mean, so this problem isn't unique to surgical training programs. Have you heard from other disciplines, from your internal medicine colleagues or pediatric colleagues about running similar studies in different disciplines?
Right. So the iCompare trial is currently ongoing. They adopted a similar design as the first trial, and they started about 6 months ago, and they have another 6 months left. And that particularly examines the issues in internal medicine in the same way. And so, unfortunately, they don't have NISQIP like we do in surgery, and so they're going to have to use Medicare data, and that takes some time to get the data back from Medicare. So they probably won't have results until late 2018, early 2019. And so I think the surgical community is going to ask the ACGME to go ahead and consider changing policies just for surgery and await the trial results for medicine. But we have heard from the medicine people that now that they know what the trial results are, that maybe they would like the flexibility reintroduced as well. I think it's important to note we didn't change the 80-hour work week in either arm. We left that in place, and nobody's arguing to change that. There's not going to be a second trial to look at that. You know, that we get questions about that a lot, and that no, we think that those rules are important to keep in place so we don't revert back to the 110-hour weeks of the 90s.
Speaking from personal experience, did you guys, when you evaluated the residents, did you ask about near misses as far as car accidents and driving home?
Yeah, so we asked them about their personal safety and how duty hour policies affected their fatigue and what impact that had on their personal safety. And there was no difference between the study arms in that. We repeated the survey with the residents after the app site just a couple days ago, and we actually included in a question about sharps and about car accidents. And so we're interested in examining those, but we're a little skeptical about whether we'll get great data from those. As you can imagine, thinking back on sharps injuries and, you know, car accidents are a little easier. You remember whether you were in one or not, but sharps injuries are a little harder. And that's why those studies are a little challenging to interpret.
Right.
The prior literature is probably a little weak on those topics because it's a hard thing to do. And the last thing you're going to do is go report to some website, you know, if we created one for the trial. But when you get stuck, that's not what's on your mind, right? Or if you're in a car accident. So notoriously hard outcomes to challenge, undoubtedly important. But we tried to capture that with the summary measure of personal safety.
Now, sir, I know your day has been surrounded by the first trial results, which has been great. I know everybody's talking about it. Is there anything else at ASC you're looking forward to?
Well, the most exciting part of the meeting for me is watching the med students, particularly the ones who are from our team, and giving their first talk ever at a meeting. So we have two med students who are giving their first talk at a scientific meeting, and we have a number of residents presenting great work. And so to me, that is very interesting and rewarding.
And you'll have to make sure they check out the podcast, How to Publish, by Dr. Melina Kibbe. We did a podcast that was very popular, and she gave some great advice on how to publish a paper.
We'll make it required listening.
And then the one question we've been finishing all of our interviews with today is, if you could go back in time and meet yourself on your first day of internship, back in those long duty hour days, with the knowledge that you have now, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
The one thing that you don't realize at the time is that it just keeps getting better and better, right? So every year you get more responsibility, you learn more, and you get to do more in surgery, and you really become a doctor as you progress through those 5 years. And every year has been better than the last. And I think, to be honest, that continues as you move into attending life. So hang in there, and it'll just keep getting better.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bill Moore, for taking the time to meet with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. So keeping along the theme of the importance of academic surgical congress here in Jacksonville, Florida, we got three of the a little bit more junior members in terms of we've had some professors on, obviously, that we've all heard from in the podcast. And so very pleased to have Dr. Melanie Morris, who's the Chief of General Surgery at the Birmingham VA, Assistant Professor of Surgery at UAB, and is also colorectal surgeon. Dr. Daniel Chu, who's Assistant Professor of Surgery, also colorectal surgeon at UAB, and Dr. Jake Greenberg, who's Assistant Professor of Surgery, and he's the Director of the University of Wisconsin Health Comprehensive Hernia Center. Thanks so much to everybody for joining us on Behind the Knife. So very quickly, Melanie, we'll start with you. So why come to this meeting? I mean, what is it about this particular meeting that it kind of appeals to you that you take time out of your busy schedule and decide to come here? And what are some of the things and the memories that you've had in the past?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think that this is a great meeting and a place where you can really find people who are doing what you do in your line of work, which may not exist in your specialty. So I like going to the ASCRS meetings, but I find that I can have more intimate interactions with people who are potential mentors or have been past mentors, as well as people who are doing kind of the work that I'm doing with outcomes research and quality improvement projects. And so I think that the ability to cross disciplines with people who are doing the same thing you're doing really just increases the value of what you do, makes it more robust, and then you can learn from people who are doing similar things.
So, Dr. Chu, looking at the schedule, we're kicking off this meeting. What are you looking forward to most? Is there a talk or a particular speaker that you're most excited about?
Yeah, so one of our I'm most excited about our residents and young faculty who are presenting here at the ASC. And, you know, even from my perspective, my first presentation ever as a resident was at the ASC in Fort Myers, Florida. That's a quick shot presentation. And so, you know, many years down the road now, seeing all the young residents, medical students presenting here, it reminds me of that. And that's really how I got started. And so, you know, just looking at the schedule itself is, you know, packed with presentations. We have very esteemed surgical leaders sharing their experiences with academics. You know, being able to network here is really also very important and very easy to do, I think, at a meeting like this where it's not tens of thousands of people. It's a very kind of a core group.
Jake, coming from the University of Wisconsin, we had Bing Rickers on earlier this morning, and we've had Herb Chen as a formal podcast, kind of big, and University of Wisconsin's at some say a stranglehold, others people say a very strong presence for both the AAS as well as the SUS. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of this meeting, kind of maybe on an institution, your wife, for example? Talk a little bit about it from institutional and then personally, since you've had such a major role in this particular Congress.
So as an institution, really all the members of the faculty view this meeting as a chance just to present their best work and from all specialties. And so our residents are heavily involved, our medical students are heavily involved, and our faculty has had some key leaders like Herb, who's been a past president, my wife, who's the current president-elect of the AAS, and Sharon Weber, who's the president of the SUS right now. So we've, as an institution, been extremely engaged in the Academic Surgical Congress. Like everyone else said, this is kind of the meeting you grow up in. I mean, I think my first presentation was in Phoenix in 2005. and it's just a meeting that you come to every year, and it's the people that you trained with and that you've worked with and spent time with through your whole professional career. It's really a great society that crosses all walks of surgery, so it's just a wonderful meeting.
So we've been rounding out all these interviews with the same question, and we'll go real quick to each of the three of you. If you could get in a time machine, travel back in time, meet yourself on your first day of surgical internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself, knowing what you know now?
Well, that's a great question. I think you have to be kind to yourself, and you have to celebrate your own personal victories, because frequently in surgical training, we don't tell people when they do a good job. We tell them when they're doing a really poor job.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's really important to remember that at the end of the day, if you did the right thing when nobody was looking, then you've done your due diligence and a good job and the best that you can do. And to be kind to yourself, because things aren't always going to go well, but if you have tried your hardest, then I wish I'd known that at the beginning, and it took a long time to learn.
Dan?
Yeah, I still remember a chief resident giving me a piece of advice that I still carry with me, and it was, you know, keep your eye on the ball, remember why you're doing this, and it's what you make out of the situation that's the most important. And so, you know, surgery residency is really hard, being a surgeon is really hard, but I think, you know, as long as you remember why you're doing this, you know, we're really fundamentally helping patients. That's the ultimate reason why we're doing this. And
absolutely.
So that keeps you kind of in line and aligned. So I think
Jake?
I think I'd do it all again in a heartbeat. I mean, it's just training is. I'd probably eat a little healthier, maybe try and gain a little less weight. But other than that, I would do it all again. It's a great ride. It's a great job and profession. We get to do amazing things for people, and we love what we do. So it's. I would absolutely do the same thing 100 times over again.
Well, guys, have fun at the meeting, and we can't thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we are absolutely thrilled to have found in the halls one of our multi-repeat offenders here on BTK, Dr. Lillian Cao, who is the Vice Chair of Research and Faculty Development and the Vice Chair of Quality at McGovern Medical School at University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. Probably got that last one wrong, Lil, but thanks for doing that. So welcome once again to BTK.
Thank you for having me again.
Obviously, we are here in Jacksonville at the ASC meeting, and one of the things we want to talk to you a little bit about, what is one of your most fond memories in terms of this meeting?
Well, I love every meeting just because of all the friends that I met. But I think the most memorable time was in San Antonio when I got elected secretary of the AAS. And we went out and I saw Melina Kibbe do a tequila shot for the first time. and with her pinky out and all.
So there's many exciting things at this meeting this year. Can you just pick out one thing you're looking forward to in the next 2 days?
Can I pick out two things?
Yeah. Sure.
So I'm really looking forward to Justin Dimmick's presidential talk because he has been a proponent of innovative strategies for delivering presentations at this meeting. So really, really looking forward to that. And then also his presidential session where Dori Segev always has walk-up music for the presenters. So I think that should be awesome.
Is there a way that our listeners that are not at the meeting can possibly hear Dr. Dimmick's address later?
That I don't think we are podcasting that yet, but maybe you guys could help us out.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic as we kind of broach new ideas. So, Lil, we've always asked you kind of if you could go back in time, and you've answered that question before, but I'm going to give a little spin on that that you have asked. What is the best piece of advice you personally have given an intern through the years on their first day?
Just call for help. I mean,
that's fantastic. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that does it for us. That's day one of three of the Academic Surgical Congress. We had a lot of fun today. We talked to a lot of people. We covered a lot of ground. So join us back. We'll have another podcast tomorrow night that's going to cover, you know, we're going to be back covering the meeting again tomorrow, and it should be great. So thanks for listening.